Welcome to Wired on Development Interviews. Today we're talking with Pierre Stamp. Pierre is a physical therapist who was introduced to me by Dr. Karen Pape as someone I needed to be talking to. Pierre earned her Doctor of Physical Therapy in the US, but her undergrad degree was from Denmark, with a strong focus on biomechanics and coaching. She has used this perspective under the mentorship of Dr. Karen Pape to develop a systematic and considered approach to intensive therapy models that is showing spectacular results. With the neuroscience coming out about the benefits of intensity for brain plasticity and the diminishing funding available for therapy, I was super eager to pick her brains about the practical issues of providing this kind of a model in a pediatric practice. I was not disappointed. Pierre and Karen's approach is getting results. Word is spreading and she has had parents flying in to her practice in New York from places as far away as New Zealand. Yes? And if you've joined the clinical corner of Wired on Development, you can listen to an interview with one of those parents where we get into it from the parent's perspective. Head on over to wiredondevelopment.com and go to the clinical corner if you're interested. You'll find it under Hot Topics in the discussion on intensives. In this interview, however, we get into it from the therapist's perspective. Scheduling, funding, tools of the trade. Pierre generously shares her tips and tricks, along with a framework that just makes it so easy to apply. Enjoy.
Get Wired on Development.
Welcome to Wired on Development.
I am very happy to be here.
So I like to start off these interviews with really understanding your journey up until this point, and especially when you decided to become a physical therapist.
I'm from Denmark. I grew up in a little village that was also an epilepsy hospital at the time. So I was around healthcare. I was around disabilities right from the beginning. I was very much involved in sports, and it was a bit of an act of defiance that I actually decided to become a physical therapist because everybody in my family were nurses. And so I decided I wanted to do something different. And I announced that I wanted to be a physical therapist, and I didn't really know what it was. But that's what I set out to do after I was done with what our high school is in Denmark. I found a job in Scotland, in Edinburgh. I was 19 and I became a house mother at the Westerly School for Spastic Children. And it was my job to take care of five little girls with CP who lived at the school. It was a boarding school. And my job was to get them up in the morning, feed them, get them ready for school, take care of them after school, wash their clothes, and basically do everything that was needed. So that was the first time I learned a little bit about CP. I then was accepted into PT school in Copenhagen. And so that's where sort of the official journey started.
That must have given you a whole different perspective on disability.
Working at the school, absolutely, it did. It wasn't clear in my head, but I definitely was interested in all that I had experienced in that year.
So then you've kind of had both sides, the sports side and the disability side.
Yes, I did. I was very involved in track and field, both as an athlete myself and also in coaching. With in youth coaching, actually. So once I started PT school, I was involved with an organization that held weekend courses to teach other people to coach children and youngsters in track and field. So I sort of slid from one role to another along coaching lines. PT school in Denmark is also there's a lot about coaching, and you really learn coaching strategies. It's a big part of the curriculum.
We did such a little bit around that when I was studying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a big part. We had exams on coaching and, you know, how to coach healthy people and how to coach people with disabilities. So it was a set part of what we did and an important part.
So when did you settle into doing what you're doing now?
Yeah, I moved with my family to the United States in 1989. I worked in a hospital in the beginning, did a little bit of pediatrics there in Boston. And then we moved to Rochester, where a couple of years later, I started doing early intervention. I loved that. And there was a lack of providers. So the county in this area asked me if I didn't think I would like to hire somebody. And so I thought, well, that sounds pretty interesting. So that's kind of how my business started. And we now provide OT, PT, speech, special education in early intervention and preschool, but we also have an outpatient clinic with the same services as well as a feeding clinic. The intensive started about 8 years ago. I have known Karen Pape for a long time, and I started working with some of her ideas, doing intensives.
How did you and Karen Pape come into contact in the early years?
I attended a workshop that she held about threshold electrical stimulation and some of her other ideas, and I started using the electrical stimulation. But what she also talked about at the conference was using music. And she had some tracks of music for gait training. So I got those tracks of music, and I was working with a little girl. She was about 8 years old at the time with CP. And I thought that was really neat. Let's try this music idea with her. And we did that, and it worked great. We could really improve her gait. She got really good at it, so she could actually turn the music on in her head and then still, change her gait. Her mother, her parents also knew Dr. Pape from Dr. Pape's clinic. So they asked if I would go to another conference with them. Karen called that 2480. That was 20 years of training for 80 years of life. So we all went, and my little girl that I worked with showed everybody how the music worked. And she did a beautiful performance. And so that sort of led me to start talking a lot more. And it's been a mentorship and a friendship that's been, I think, about 20 years now.
That's such an amazing story. So you don't hear a lot about that music approach
right
anymore. Like, I've heard a couple of people mention it, discussing Karen Pape, but I haven't actually seen a lot around that. Do you still use it?
Oh, I use it a lot. Yes, I do. It's like a substitution system. Karen talks about that in her book as well. It's sort of the auditory motor substitution, just as well as you can do visual motor. It works beautifully if you have music with a really good cadence. So I use that. It's one of my tools in my toolbox when I do intensives.
Where's that music come from? Is it a specific track?
It was some music that that Karen Pape had had somebody make, but you can pick music. We have children pick their own music as long as it has a good rhythm that supports gait, then any music that they enjoy. We do a lot of treadmill training with music. And I think from ourselves, we know that once you hear music, something happens in your body and you pick up the rhythm. And I think it's very helpful. It's often go home and have that as a part of their home training.
So what kind of kids do you use it on?
I use it on kids from, when I do gait training. So even little kids, age 3, 4, whenever they start walking, I use it with them. And all the way up, I've had a few adults here, and they also enjoy it. So it's just one tool in the toolbox.
Does it need to have a certain rhythm or beat or speed or anything like that?
Yeah, it has to have a beat that fits with their gait. They usually try, and once they've tried the music I have, they kind of know what to look for. But music is, in my mind, a very powerful tool for motor training.
Absolutely. You'll have to give me some examples of tracks that you use so I can get my head around
it. We'll do that.
What sort of background training do you have, Pierre?
So I did some NDT training in Denmark. We did not have access to like the 8-week course and things like that. But I did some NDT training. I did a lot of work with PNF and Brunstrom and some of those techniques. So I've done quite a bit of soft tissue learning. So I did a beautiful course with Veggie Beam. So lots of weekend courses along the way.
Have there been any sort of pivot points or times when you've kind of completely changed direction or changed the way you think about what you're doing?
Yes. I think sort of there was a sort of a pivotal moment for me when I went to the three-step conference for the APTA. We started talking about neuroplasticity. In hindsight, Karen Pape has talked about and taught about neuroplasticity, but that conference was, if anything, a big aha moment for me, sort of explaining things better, because, you know, we've all seen change, but at the same time, we learned that change is not possible. So I think that put a name to it, if you want. So I think that from that point on, and then all the time that I have spent with Karen as my mentor has definitely been a huge influence. I mean, that's the reason I'm doing what I'm doing now and how I do it.
Right. So what did you change when you came back from that conference?
I think it was my understanding of what was happening more than anything else, but also really putting thought into what motor learning is, what are the different components of motor learning that I have to think about, things like attention, task-specific training, all those things, I think, made more sense to me, and I could sort of create a framework with it in my mind that was anchored. And I think that was the biggest change for me. More thoughtfulness in the process.
So a little bit more sort of directed in what you were trying to achieve.
Yep.
So did you start the intensives following on from that conference, or was that more just a gradual process?
It was a little bit later than the conference. I think it's been, you know, that conference, I think, was in 2005. So I would say we've been doing them for about 8 years. I would say we've done them. In the beginning, it was very sporadic, a kid here, a kid there. And then over time, as the program, you know, it's trial and error. I tried many different things, and I finally felt that I had a system that worked. And that's when things picked up.
Do you predominantly only do intensives now, or do you still see kids on more sort of regular weekly sessions that are ongoing?
I do both. I also, you know, I also run my business, and I see mostly kids in the outpatient clinic. I see a fair amount of children with brachial plexus injuries, which has been another path that I was on for a while, and for that matter, I still am. I pick up a slack in the clinic when we don't have intensives. So any type of kids that you would see in an outpatient clinic as well.
Right.
I love treating. Okay. Treating is my passion for sure.
It makes the day so much better.
It definitely does.
So what does an intensive block look like?
The intensive block, there are different lengths of time that we do. We do short intensives, which are 3 days usually, and we do 5 days, and we do 10 days. The more I've done it, the more I've done the shorter, and advised parents on doing the shorter intensives, and found that the process that goes into to what we can actually find out in, you know, in 3 or 5 days is often enough for the type of work that we do for them to take the benefit and go home and continue training.
The shorter time periods are actually something that you're doing more of, that you prefer to do?
I really enjoy both. It all depends on the children. And I think it's, you know, that's, it's a very individualized approach. I always ask to see videos and get some medical history before we even confirm that that children would benefit from this program. And so I have a little bit of insight into what they look like, what they can do, and what the parents' goals are. So that's how we guide them. We have children who come from very far, who often stay with us longer, and we have kids that are closer by who do shorter intensives, but do them maybe a little bit more frequently, or they do a short intensive and then they go on to other types of training.
Right. So the home program must be a very important component of the whole package.
It is a very important component. I think the most important piece, I feel, is the education piece that goes along with it. I think I'm always surprised at how much I could offer in terms of, you know, parents understanding and the children for that matter also of what their CP is, and how to reach the goals that, that they set. And I think the other important piece is to really stress what we think is possible. And I think those things are, those are the most important pieces. And if they go home understanding what needs to happen in order to reach the goal that they have been part of setting. These are not my goals. These are the children's goals if they're a little bit older, or the parents' goals. And then we outline a very clear path for them of what they need to do in order to reach that goal.
So could you walk me through a little case study of somebody that you've seen, just so that I can get a picture of it in my head?
Yep, I can definitely do that. So we had a very good one just a couple weeks ago. It was a 14-year-old boy who came up for 3 days. He had a fairly recent SDR surgery and had a lot of weakness. And when we started intensive, I had seen the videos, I had done all of that. And we always start with an interview. And I asked him what was his goal. And he told me that he really wanted to be independent with many more things before college. And so that was what we kept talking about as we progressed. We then do a very thorough assessment. We assess obviously strength and range of motion and everything else that goes along with a neuromuscular assessment. And then we looked at what was his best performance. And for him, we had to get him supported, we put him into some body support garments and saw what that did to his body. And along the way, we use video. So we do video analysis. I would, you know, take a video, show him what it looked like, show him what it is where my eyes go and why. So there's this ongoing teaching all the time with both the children and the family. So what are the most important muscles that we have to work on right now? What are the, you know, what would that do to movement patterns? And what would that do to overall function? So we use this framework. We always start with alignment. So alignment being starting from the trunk and going distal. So again, we use a lot of trunk garments, Theratogs, BOs, DMOs, Protec garments, whatever we need to do, we do that. So that's always the first thing we make sure that there is good alignment. And that's when we start, you know, we videotape. So we put him in alignment, we videotaped him, and he could see the difference of what that does. Yes, he was able to keep his hips straighter, etc. And then we start going more detailed. So what is it? Where would I go in his body with his body to get the best possible result? So for him, we needed to work on on awareness and activation. He had really poor ability to activate his quads and his glutes, so he was very crouched. He was very weak, but we couldn't really do much strength training if you can't activate your muscles. So that's what we focused on. I try to find out where do I get the best result? What muscle group do I need to start with? And that's often a trial and error. And this is where I use a lot of biofeedback training. So I have a pretty simple biofeedback setup. So I decided that for him, I thought once his trunk was in good alignment that we should go for his quads. And so we did spend some time on quad activation. I use a sort of a combination of NMES for creating awareness, EMG biofeedback, and EMG triggered stimulation. It all depends on the child and what response I get. But within a pretty short time, he was able to actively recruit his quads. And by recruiting his quads, he also recruited his glutes. So he was actually able to come up in an upright, beautiful posture that we could then document for him with videos and pictures. And he could see the difference right away. And, you know, the biofeedback in particular is really an aha moment for some of these kids. I think we have to remember that they don't know what normal activation is. They don't have a map of what it is they're supposed to do. I actually once had a child doing biofeedback for dorsiflexion. He looked up at me and he said, "Oh, that's what dorsiflexion is. I wish somebody had told me." So, like, okay, we can do this. So for this young man, we did work along those activation lines, posture work, trying to put some of that into function. We got him on the treadmill, and he was able to show us a pretty nice gait patterns when he was supported by the treadmill and the different garments and reps that we rig up during an intensive. At the same time as we discussed training, you know, what is training? What is, you know, what can you do? A 14-year-old is often done with sort of the traditional PT that we do. And this is where I often sort of go much more along the coaching lines and get the kids hooked up with a trainer at home and with more of a coaching program. We did that for a couple of days. And then on the last day is always sort of, how do we send the child and the family home with a good program? And this is where we go back to the original goal. At that point, we had talked and taught so much that he understood what he needed to do in order to reach his goal. You know, he has a long time to reach it, but he was actually able to verbalize that. You know, on the first day, we had created a chart where he told me about all the things that he couldn't do. And so we picked the chart up again, put it on the wall, and he was able to understand how to prioritize training from this point on in order to get to where he wanted to go. And this is where we get the motivation and the buy-in from both the children and the families. He understood that at this point he had to do we sent him home to do a lot of pool training, pool jogging, so we could get him out of gravity because of his profound weakness. So we set him up with a pool program for both endurance and strength and gait. And then he will progress as he gets stronger. But I think the understanding of what are the components that are necessary, I think that's what's often missing when we talk to parents and children. And if they don't understand what the importance is of the intervention and where does it lead to, then you can't be motivated. you know, if it's been the same goal for a long time or the same exercises. I hear that all the time. We're doing the same thing every time we go. You know, that's, I couldn't keep my motivation going either. And so, so that's the buy-in. And I know people often ask, you know, what do you really think it's going to work over time? And I said, you know, there, I know that they know the components that are necessary, but you have to buy into it. This is, you know, I can't, and I don't think anybody can fix anything in a week or two. It has to be ongoing into daily life.
So ideally, how much time would you have between intensive blocks?
I think it all depends on the child. You know, everything we do here is completely individualized. So some kids I see once a year. Sometimes I see people once, and they're well on their way. You know, it varies a lot. We have kids who come back, you know, every 3 months for maybe just a day or 2 days for just a sort of a tune-up. So we can do, it's my own practice. I can be individualized, and we can create things in such a way that it works for the kids and the families as well.
A big stumbling block is often the billing and how families pay for blocks of therapy. How do you deal with that?
You know, there are many different health systems around. So I can certainly speak for, you know, what we can do in the state of New York. Insurance does not really work for intensives for us as an independent freestanding practice. We have tried that, but that has not gone particularly well. So funding, for the most part, comes from parents. Parents find funding. There are so many foundations out there that pay. We've had many, many families come in with foundation funding. We can create shorter periods, certainly, you know, with an eye to what they can afford. We've also started a couple of children locally with school districts. So children here get their services through school. And we have had a couple of school districts who have allowed us to use the therapy that was allotted in segments. So been able to create sort of intensive therapy for those children. It's very few up until now, but so far it has gone well. But it's definitely it's a pilot, and it's a heavy system to change, because, you know, everybody's comfortable with how service has always been delivered, and it's been 2 times 30 minutes. For every child, no matter what they need to work on, that's kind of what's automatically given in this area. Or children get nothing. So our petition has been, why don't we take those 30-minute visits twice a week and pool them? It's a work in progress, and it takes a lot of convincing and teaching. But we have found people who are intrigued and willing to try. So we're hoping that we can sort of present that model with some good results at some point.
Yeah, I think you mentioned you'd had a couple of successes the last time we spoke with some kids where you'd used the same amount of funding and just got fantastic outcomes.
Yes, we have. The first child we had, we tried it with, had been six through the school year. And we approached the school district and said, okay, she's missed all these visits. If we put them into an intensive, a 2-week intensive, would you let us do that? And they were like, well, we're going to pay for it anyway, so why not? Go ahead. And this child did incredibly well. She, from walking with a gait trainer, a Rifton gait trainer, or on her knees, to being an independent walker within the 2-week span that we had her. And she had been getting the usual amount of therapy, the same amount of therapy, but delivered in a different way. So it doesn't really cost more. I think the big challenge is how to maybe convince insurance companies of that. And so far, I will readily admit that we have not been able to do that.
So with this little one that you saw at the school, when you did a two-week intensive, how long were each session on any given day?
Our traditional sessions run 2 hours in the morning, and then we have a break and we run another hour in the afternoon. And that has worked. And again, we do individualize that, but that's sort of the main model that we use. And so that was how she was seen in for those 2 weeks. And curiously enough, the school district contacted us close to the following summer and said, could she just come back and learn to do better with feeding? So they just gave us sessions and we pooled them. And she went into the feeding clinic and did a feeding intensive with fabulous results again. It's the focus. I really do believe it's everybody right. Can focus on the goal.
So when you did the intensives with this little girl, was it 2 hours of PT or was it a mix of disciplines for those sort of 3 hours a day?
For the first intensive we did, it was all PT. The feeding intensive was OT and speech that we combined.
So you're kind of targeting what needs to be worked on around the goals.
And we're lucky because we have all disciplines here. And, you know, oftentimes when we have children come in, we realize that we really should have an OT come in on this. And, you know, we're very lucky that we can often make that happen. So we can sort of create the intensive as we go. So if we need the OT, we'll pull the OT in for, you know, enough time at least to consult and oftentimes to do some work as well. We do have a pretty set framework that we follow in order to get to everything that we want to cover with the kids. The sort of the overriding process is really that form precedes function. So we don't go anywhere near function until we have good form. Right. And in order to get good form, we go through our framework, which always starts with alignment. We work on trunk alignment first, and then we go to the extremities depending on what we're working on. And after we work on alignment, we work on awareness, being how aware is the child of their body. How aware are they of specific parts of their bodies? And we often find that that's a difficult task. After we have addressed awareness, we go to what we call activation, which is muscle recruitment. And for that, we look at, you know, obviously their ability to recruit muscle groups. For the older children, we look closely at both relaxation and recruitment. So we can teach them to recruit muscles in isolation and then from there on, we can move to more functional tasks with good muscle recruitments. And from there, we can move towards strength training, but we never get to strength training before we have all our other parts of the framework in place.
So when you're talking about alignment, that's where you're going with Theratogs or Theratogs, and that sort of splinting is alignment, and awareness would be around SPIO and
Yes. So that's when we work. That's really, really more activation. We do biofeedback a lot for awareness as well as for muscle activation. And we also use EMG-triggered stimulation, which is really a combination of EMG biofeedback and NMES. It sort of takes the best of both.
Okay. So I'm just interested in, because a lot of that is quite technical stuff, and where you started with that and developed your skills.
You know, biofeedback in and of itself is really not complicated. It's really where we get a lot of the aha moments, but there is very simple biofeedback systems on the market. It's been around for a long, long time. I always say to therapists that it's something that you just play with. And I honestly have many parents who take it with them and they work on it at home, and the kids really like it, and they're very motivated by biofeedback. It's almost like a little computer game. But it could be as simple as a sound. So you activate your muscle and you hear a sound. It's really like cause effect. So it can be complicated. And I think people think of biofeedback as something really complicated and very technical, but it really isn't. You can certainly make it complicated, but that's not necessary at all with the work we do.
Right. And then the NMES and the EMG and stuff?
The NMES is neuromuscular electrical stimulation, just like we all know about it, which is really, you know, the activation again. You know, you stim the muscle and you get a response. So EMG triggered muscle stimulation is really a combination of the EMG biofeedback and the NMES, where the child uses biofeedback, and it is set so that at some point in the activation, they will trigger the stimulator to add stimulation and enhance really the activation. So that gets a little bit more technical than the other two, but still not a lot.
So what units are you using for that? Yeah.
I use a Canadian company called Thought Technology, and this is a unit. There's a unit that has all these three modalities in it, and that is actually a unit that Karen Pape and I, we worked with the company on developing the protocols for that. They also have a very simple biofeedback unit that all you have is light and sound.
Okay.
But there are many others out there as well.
Okay. So that framework is, it really makes it a lot clearer as to what you're doing in your intensives and why you kind of need that intensive time. It's not like you're just bringing the kids in and right. doing a lot of repetition
yes.
of activities and that sort of thing, whereas you kind of leaving that right till the end.
We're leaving it right to the end. We are also not really, we're not focusing on function until we can really practice good function. So once you have all these pieces in place, that's when you can sort of start your training. And I use the analogy of coaching for this, because if you are into sports, and I talk to the children and parents about this a lot, if you're into sports, there is no coach who would let you practice your sport without having good form and support.
Right.
So it is, that's exactly what we do. And that's, I think, is what makes the difference, that once you really address that, then you see the good results. And it looks better and it feels better, and therefore, you know, the carryover is better and better understood.
Yeah. So when you get into the strengthening phase, mm-hmm. What does that look like in terms of therapy time, or is that stuff that kids are doing at home as home programs?
Most of that will then happen at home. For the longer intensives, we do strengthening. I mostly do strengthening with functional tasks with the kids. We do not have a cage where we are. So if that is something parents have thought about, or we think, then we send them off and recommend that. We access pools. We don't have a pool in my clinic, but we access local pools, and we do take the kids in the water and do jogging in water, strength training in water, gait training in water, as good as we can in a regular public pool.
Mm-hmm.
Using a buoyancy device called a wet vest.
Right.
So again, these are all things that can go home. Anybody can join the Y, put the wet vest on, and go and do the training that we have worked out for them as part of this framework. So then within each of these alignment, awareness, activation, and strength, it depends what the therapist has in his or her toolbox. And it doesn't have to be exactly what I have in my toolbox. These are examples of ways that I work on these different things, but other people may have other techniques that are just as good as the ones I'm using. So as long as I think you keep to the process, there are probably many other ways to get to the goal than the specific ones that I'm using.
Right. So just for people listening, just go through the process again.
Okay. So we start with alignment, and this is where we add garments and splints and kinesio tape and whatever else we do. After we have good alignment, we go to awareness training. That could be work in front of a mirror. It could be using sensory strategies such as vibration, the compression, the plain compression garments are great for awareness. After we have good awareness, we move on to muscle activation and use facilitation techniques. We can use vibration. These are all techniques that every therapist knows how to do. Mm-hmm. And then in my toolbox, I then have some of these more technical things that I do. After that, we move towards strength and use, the tools we have for strengthening. And in our intensives, other than the biofeedback and some of the stim, we really do not have any equipment that is not available to pretty much anybody. We have a treadmill, and then we have balls, and we have space and mats and weights. That's about it. So those are my tools to get there. But, other people may have other tools that they are really good at using, and they can do the same thing.
Exactly. As long as they're following that.
Yes. And I think of all of those, alignment is the key.
Yes.
We don't move on if we can't get alignment. And this is where before the children come in for the intensive, I review videos. And if I think there are alignment difficulties that I cannot address, those are addressed before the children come in. That could be with spasticity management. So if I can detect that out of the videos I'm watching, then that is my recommendation. And then to wait with intensive until that is taken care of. Or it could be updating braces or splints.
Okay. So just around those areas, a sort of contentious topic at the moment is around stretching.
Yes.
So I'd just be interested to hear what your thoughts are and what you're recommending for families or kids around stretching, maintaining range of movement, or increasing right. it.
We do, I think the alignment in and of itself will help maintain range of motion. We recommend night splints. We also lately have worked a lot with more dynamic forms of stretching where we alternate between activation and stretching. For example, having the child on a wedge and standing, by a wall, and they come up, we pull them up on toes, and then they come down with their heels. So we play around with a lot of different stretching methods, but I rarely send somebody home stretching the way we used to do 10 stretches. The other thing we always say is that you got to use heat. So, if you end up sitting in a, with splints on for stretching or sitting in some other apparatus, then use heat first.
Right.
I teach parents how to do some simple myofascial techniques and massage. We often recommend that the children maybe should go see somebody professional for some of this soft tissue work.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Okay, so you also talked a little bit about the goal setting, about
yes.
you described like a poster that you had put some of the goals on.
So we're always looking for the best performance as our goal. And this is kind of, this is another thing that we tease out with the intensive is, you know, where do we think we can go? What's the best possible? And I find it, you know, it's always helpful for both the children and the parents, depending on the age of the child, to do. We do use these big wall charts, sticky charts. For the child I was, the young boy I was describing, we put on what we were working towards, what were the goals. We put them on the chart. We record progress towards goals. With even with younger children, you know, four years old, 5 years old, use these charts so they know what we're working on to the degree that they can understand it. And the parents know what we're working on. You can see progress towards what it is that we're describing. And we send the charts home and they continue doing some form of charting or training journaling, depending again on the age of the child.
Okay, so kind of best performance becomes the goal.
Best performance is the goal. And I think this is where we shortchange our children, our kids with CP. I think sometimes we just think that, you know, it's just good enough, you know, but what if he could do much better? Knowing that there is possibilities beyond what's the good enough, I think it certainly is what motivates me to get this process going. That is very motivating for them to see and understand that. And we really look at that as a measure of brain recovery. And neuroplasticity.
Yeah. So what sort of families or kids don't do well with intensives?
I think that's a tough question. Not do well with these. I think that families have to understand that this is just the beginning of a process. I think if they think that they can come in and a week later we've solved all the problems and you don't have to worry about it again, that won't go well. So I think we make sure that discussion has been had ahead of time. I usually say it's no different for any of us. If I want to lose weight and I, you know, go into a program where I exercise and diet, I lose weight, but if I don't keep it up when I'm done with that particular program, I'm just going to gain weight again. Yeah. Or, you know, fitness, anything like that. So just really having that understanding, I think is crucial. I have met kids that did not want to be with us. And for the most part, we end up sort of winning them over once they see what the process is and what's possible.
I'll just jump into some of the questions then that some therapists sent through.
Sure.
So the first one is, what are some of the techniques you use with minimal equipment that are effective and why?
I think most of the techniques that we have spoken about, maybe, you know, with the exception of the EMG-triggered biofeedback, these are really all pretty low tech interventions. So I don't really think there's any of them that are not pretty simple to use, if that answers the question.
Yep. I think you did cover most of that when we were going through the protocol.
Yeah. Yep.
The next one says, do you have any recommendations on how to present the idea of an intensive program to supervisors of a multidisciplinary pediatric outpatient clinic where patients are seen every 30 minutes? Scheduling and maintaining productivity are the concerns, but this intensive method of treatment seems extremely effective. Do you have any suggestions on how to logistically schedule the day, week, or month?
Okay. So we are in the midst, almost done with a feasibility project for intensives, looking at exactly, you know, how feasible is it to run this program, because we also run an outpatient clinic, and it looks like it's actually financially good to do. In terms of scheduling, I think, you know, we schedule these blocks out and we have therapists that go into blocks. I have a therapist who's going to go on maternity leave. I know that come March, she's not going to be there. So, you know, I can do fewer intensives while she's out on maternity. So in a way that eases scheduling. You can schedule for vacations and, you know, so I think in many ways, it's easy to do. Did that answer the question?
I think the difficulty is when you've got a busy clinic already and you've kind of got kids booked up every half hour, and suddenly or somehow have to make the space to start fitting in intensives. Like, logistically, when you said you first started, you were just doing a kid here or there, and then you've actually kind of grown it to be more sort of a standard way of practicing.
Right. So we are most busy in our clinic in the afternoons, and so all our intensives are pretty much done by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, except if we have really young children that need a longer nap before between the two sessions that we do. So in terms of space, we're actually using our space much better because our clinic was never full in the mornings.
Right.
And staff-wise as well, we can man that. And it's something you know ahead of time, you know, at least for us with the clinic, you never quite know how busy you're going to be. So at least for us, that changes based on time of the year and things like that.
Right. So do you sort of just block off times in your schedule where you're going to fit intensives into that, or do you just, as they come in, you make the time available?
These are generally planned pretty far in advance. So I know, you know, we have a whole chart with open weeks depending on our staffing. So when somebody calls and books an intensive, they will be offered one of those slots. And it's pretty much never next week, because there is some planning that go into that on both ends.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy, you know, depends on how many do you want at the same time. We run two at a time, not all the time, but again, it depends on staffing.
Okay, so you're running two intensives concurrently, and then the rest of the day is sort of scheduled outpatient appointments and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. We have the ability to run two, and we run them in the morning,
right?
With two different therapists, or we often mix OT in there. So, but those are all pretty much finished by 1 o'clock.
Right. I think that. Before, when I was thinking about intensives, I was thinking sort of the more long term, like, you know, 3-4 times a week for 6 weeks. That's quite hard to keep up that sort of intensity. But if you're doing sort of really short, focused intensive blocks, it sounds much more doable.
Right. And I think, you know, also it's keeps motivation going.
Yeah.
For everybody. I have done sort of home-based intensives as well. We have dabbled in that too.
Right.
So I think there's many ways to go about it. If you think outside the box and look at what you have and approach the payers with the idea that this is really not any more expensive, but what if it was really much more helpful?
Right.
I think that's the way we have to present it, because the way I see it is it's very hard to change habits out there.
It is a bit of a mindset, but I think your structured framework and your real intentionality about what you're doing makes it so much more meaningful and doable.
Right. And it is, like I spoke about earlier, I think it is sellable if you do it, if you sort of present it that way. It's not, we're not asking for a lot more money. We're asking to use the money in a different way.
Right. So the last question, they said, working in the public health system, I'm limited by resources and number of treatment sessions we can offer. I'm talking 6 sessions in total. and I'm struggling with this mm-hmm. given the success that I know intensive blocks can provide. Do you have any suggestions on how I can take what you recommend and apply it to my situation of limited service delivery?
I may not think it's ideal, but, you know, again, if you use a structured framework and everybody understands where they're going, chances are that you're going to have a lot more carryover.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, maybe one way of looking at it. We have families who receive services through, you know, regular channels of school and early intervention, et cetera, who find funding for additional, looking at this as an additional push. There's lots of ways that families may be able to find funding for additional programs. I'm often thinking about this as you enroll your child in a camp in the summer, and, you know, that's not paid for, or you enroll them in sports.
It's a different mindset, because sometimes parents are just like, well, that's what's been funded, so that's what we need to do. And
yes, but, you know, I think, again, the sports analogies really help everybody think outside of the box.
Absolutely. So that's the other thing, I think, working with families, is sometimes you provide a home program, go over the activities, and then they go away with it, and then they may have questions or come back with things that aren't working a few weeks down the line. So how do you manage that? Mm-hmm.
We do stay in touch, at least in the first few weeks, until all the pieces are in place. A lot of families go home and continue their programs with trainers or in a gym, or they go to the Y, and we have to sort of sort out the kinks of that. And we're doing lots of emails and lots of phone conversations. And we also are very willing to talk to the home therapist and the home team to make sure that everybody's on the same place and we can carry this through.
Right. That's another aspect of it, though, that still continues to take up more time. So even though you've done the maybe 3 hours a day for a week, then there's still ongoing needs that are just time-consuming, really.
Right. There are. And, you know, we can only do this to a degree. We obviously cannot spend many hours on the phone. And we have families who choose to set up some consultations with us. And once we've seen the children, we can do that over the phone or over Skype. It's not something I do without knowing the children. And so that we get paid for.
Right.
So once they are sort of home and we need to progress a home program, that's how we do that.
Okay. And before you see the kids for intensives, you're looking at their videos, getting a bit of a history, putting a bit of a plan together. How much time does that mm-hmm. take you?
I would say that it's about an hour, hour and a half, I would say, that I spend ahead of them coming. It depends a little bit on, you know, on case by case. But we actually timed that out in our feasibility study that we're finishing right now. And also, how much time do we spend when they're here on writing up? We have a certain way we write up our programs. How much time do we spend on that? How much time do we spend after the intensive is over? And so that was all calculated into how we looked at the feasibility of doing intensive.
So that's exciting that you're doing a study.
It's a group of DPT students. They're in their last semester, and this is their business class. And so it's been very helpful to actually look at all, you know, look at the cost.
Yeah. So what frustrates you about current beliefs and practices?
I think the same old is what's most frustrating for me. The not asking questions or, you know, thinking outside of the box is, I think, most frustrating. What is also frustrating is that I think we're shortchanging children, especially on the milder end of CP, and we're not giving them what could ultimately be a way to a really good function. Just because, at least where I am, they're considered good enough. So therapy is withdrawn. And it's often withdrawn right at the time when they go into puberty, which is growth spurts. It's actually, that's one of the periods of really good plasticity where you can take advantage. So I think those are the things that are frustrating.
Yeah.
But those are the things that we need to work on.
Right. So what are common mistakes that therapists themselves make addressing intensives?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I mean, not working with the best form, you know, can be a detriment. And I think it can be a detriment to maintaining function. You know, I have seen kids who have been away, and I've heard families talk about constraint camps where the children go, but they're never put in alignment. So they sit and practice movement for hours in bad alignments. And I think that's something to really think about.
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up. And I think just talking about intensives, that there's so many different models that have the same name.
Right, right. And I think that's, I think this intensive is really an intensive model that can be applied to many other types of intensives. So, you know, you can go into the cage training with all this in place. You can go to constraint with all this in place. Maybe thinking about this process sort of as the foundation that needs to be in place before you build all the other things. But I think they would do much better with pre-intensive work.
Right. So just a couple of questions to wrap up then. Who is currently noteworthy for you?
I think the work that is being done in Australia, often headed by Iona Novak, is phenomenal. I think there are many extremely talented people that have sort of blazed the way. I'm thinking of, you know, Billy Cusack and the Thera Talks. I think there are many people who have been very inventive that the rest of us can take advantage of.
Right. So your best advice to new therapists starting out in pediatrics?
To have good mentors, asking questions of your more experienced peers, I think is really important. Learn from many people. I think many people, different therapists have bring different things to the table. And I always say, if I didn't learn anything today, it was not a good day. That's kind of a saying that we have in our office. Because, you know, I've done this for close to 40 years, but I still get surprised and learn new things. And, you know, I think that's why we can be excited to be therapist. I always say, I'm so glad I became a PT because I can learn every day something
new. So what
new.
Did you learn today?
What I learned today was I have a problem with technology in my computer. No, I also, I worked with a young boy this morning, and he came back for a sort of a checkup, an intensives checkup. And, you know, we worked again on tweaking his alignment, and I learned something else today about, you know, what worked for him. We did some visual motor rehearsal that he hadn't had a lot of before, and we had a lot of that today, and that was sort of another aha moment. So I think constantly applying some of these ideas to different kids at different times, that's what I learned.
Yeah, I just came across that recently because it's quite an exciting extra tool to have, I think.
It works beautifully. You know, it's another coaching right. tool. I mean, I use it often with kids, and they can, and I love to videotape it and show them the before and after, and it's mind-boggling from time to time. So it's another tool, and it's fun to do. You can do it with yourselves. You can change your own performance by doing a visual motor rehearsal.
So just give us a practical example of how you did it, what you were actually working on, and what you did for it.
He was really choppy with his gait. So he's a kid that we're fine-tuning. So I told him to close his eyes and see himself. I always say to see a video of yourself and where, you know, all your movements are really smooth and you just walk along the floor, your gait is quiet, and we, you know, I put different things in there for them to do. And then I tell them that I'm going to stop talking and they're going to see this video of themselves. And so once they've seen it, they open their eyes and they don't say anything. We just go. And you should try it. It's fascinating what happens.
Yeah,
you can do that when you do coordination exercises with children. And you tell them to look at the video of themselves doing it perfect. And it's very interesting. I sometimes set up that, you know, they have a little secret reminder on them. It could be like a little girl has a little bracelet, and every time she sees her bracelet, she pauses and does just a little bit of visual motor rehearsal before she keeps going. It works really well too if they anticipate that a task is going to be really difficult. And I think that's something our kids do a lot. And you tell them that, you know, you just pause and you think about it and you see it and then you do it. And oftentimes that takes that anxiety away because they've already practiced it in their mind. You can do it pretty early, and it's a fun game to play.
So best books to have in your back pocket?
I use anatomy books a lot still to this day. When I really have to think something through, I go back to my anatomy books. I go back to sort of my basic training and coaching books. I love how you post things. I don't have enough time to read, so I use some of these opportunities to hear about new things out there. I wish I had more times to study my books.
We all do. I'm so glad you said you go back to your anatomy books. I'm not the only one who can't remember.
Oh, no. I'm not shy to pull them out and show to the kids and the parents, too.
Yeah, if people have questions about intensives or want to learn more, what would you advise them?
They're more than welcome to send me an email, and we can talk a little bit about it. We're putting together some workshops about this, trying to get to figure out if some of this can be in online segments. So hopefully we can spread the word a little bit about this soon, because it's fun to do.
Oh, that's great to hear. They can get hold of your email via your website?
Yes. And the website is just being revamped, so it should have, it has actually a lot of parent testimonials and stories on it. So it talks very briefly about the process as well.
And so then just the wrap up question is, how would you advise therapists who want to develop excellence or become leaders in the field of pediatric neurodevelopment?
Put together what you love. Because I think if you find things that you love to do, techniques that you love to do, then you're going to be a much better therapist, and be analytical and learn to self-evaluate, I think is an important piece as well.
Yeah, that's a really important piece. Thank you for that, Pia. That was awesome.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. You'll find links to everything we discussed in this interview at wiredondevelopment.com. And if you haven't already, whilst you're there, you can sign up for the Seriously Smart Snippets. These are bite-sized emails delivered weekly to your inbox with useful snippets from past interviews to enhance your learning and keep you inspired. Thanks for listening, and a special thanks to those of you that take the time to connect and send me your thoughts and feedback. It really does make my day. Cheers.